Welcome to Smashing the Plateau. We help you get unstuck so you can do what you love and get paid what you're worth consistently. I'm your host, David Schreiner Khan.
When you look after your people, when you create a thriving workplace, then profit will be an outcome.
Today on episode 472 of Smashing the Plateau, I'm here with the CEO and founder of Advancing Wellness, Mari Ryan. I'm going to ask Mari how different kinds of businesses can create thriving workplaces and much more. Find out more about Mari along with all of our previous episodes at smashingtheplateau.com. Now, before we jump into this incredibly important topic with Mari, I want to tell you a little bit about how you can stand out from your competition. It's a noisy world out there. Your business is unique, and you want someone on your team who can really help you smash through the digital chaos and get noticed by your ideal customers. With the capabilities to meet all of your marketing needs, SiteHub can make your unique vision come to life. At the end of this episode, you will have an opportunity to listen to SiteHub's CEO, Sean McKay, offer you tips to help you get noticed by your ideal customers. So make sure you listen all the way to the end to get Sean's marketing tip. And for my listeners, SiteHub is offering a free guided workshop to help you determine your unique value. You can get your free copy at smashingtheplateau.com/SiteHub. That's smashingtheplateau.com/SiteHub. Now let's welcome Mari Ryan. Mari is the CEO and founder of Advancing Wellness. She's an expert in workplace well-being. Mari leverages over 30 years of business experience in various marketing, consulting, and executive roles across a variety of different industries. For the past decade, Mari has been creating thriving workplaces through her consulting work and speaking on worksite well-being. Mari earned a bachelor's degree from Lesley University, an MBA from Boston University, a master's degree in health promotion from Nebraska Methodist College, and she is a certified worksite wellness consultant. Mari is an active member of the National Speakers Association, and she is the author of the award-winning book, The Thriving Hive, How People-Centric Workplaces Ignite Engagement and Fuel Results. Mari, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, David. It's always nice to spend time with you.
Same here. So, Mari, what is a thriving workplace?
A thriving workplace is one that we have to look at from a couple of dimensions. First, we have to look at it from the perspective of the people, and that is the employees who work there. And it has to be a workplace that really, in some ways, in many ways, looks after their well-being and shows that the organization cares for them. We all know that every business, in order to be successful and achieve their business objectives, has to really, you know, you can't achieve those business objectives without your people. So we need to be able to demonstrate that we care for people and that we then, you know, can really make them feel like they're an important part of what this organization, you know, any organization will do. We also have to remember to look at it from the business perspective, right? That we are, you know, businesses are there to make profit, to provide impact in many different ways in the world. And from my viewpoint, profit is an outcome. When you look after your people, when you create a thriving workplace, then profit, you know, will be an outcome that will result.
Mari, what are some of the differences in creating a thriving workplace between a very big organization, you know, like a major corporation, a smaller business, which is what many businesses in the world are, with maybe a handful of people or a few dozen people, and with a very tiny business that may have one primary person who delivers the solution to the client?
Well, in the micro business, we have to take the solopreneur. You know, the solopreneur needs to make sure that they are surrounded by supportive individuals who can help them, you know, reinforce for them what they're doing, you know, be that support network for them. So even at the solopreneur level, we need to make sure that we have, you know, the right kinds of support to be able to help us know that, you know, the work we're doing is meaningful and to help keep us motivated and on the right track. At the micro business level, you know, those organizations, you know, America runs on small businesses because they make up the majority of the businesses in this country. And smaller businesses in many ways have a lot of advantages because it's easier to communicate. You know, everybody knows what everyone else is doing. You're dependent on each other to be able to achieve the goals of the organization. So I think in some ways it's easier in smaller organizations, but it's still as critical. It's especially in smaller organizations, everybody's got to carry their weight. So everybody needs to really know how their contribution matters and the level to which they are cared for in making that contribution. In larger organizations, it is a little harder because there are so many more people involved, so many different levels of, you know, sometimes bureaucracy. But often what we see is that it's the managers, two levels. The managers play such a key role in showing people that you care, but also the leaders. The leaders really have to define the culture, establish the norms and the behaviors in that organization that really demonstrate that you care. Let me give you an example on this. When I was researching my book, I spoke with about a dozen or so CEOs to find out from them what it takes to create high-performing organizations. One of the CEOs I spoke with is a CEO of a pharmaceutical company. And they had about 400 employees when I spoke with him. And he had two things that he felt were really critical to the success of his organization. One was that he interviewed every single person who got hired. And I got the obvious question I said to him, is that sustainable over time? He said, it has to be sustainable because that's how I connect with the people who come to work here and how they know that I care about who they are and what their role will be in the organization. And I thought that was a pretty interesting and meaningful story. The second piece that they did, which was really interesting, was, you know, high pressure organization, pharmaceutical, you know, making, testing and developing drugs that are going to impact people's lives. They take a portion of their workforce every Friday and they go bowling. They kick back for an hour and a half, and they just have fun. And they connect with each other in a way that's meaningful. It gives people an opportunity to step outside their work roles and just have fun. He said that's a core piece of the culture in their organization.
Wow. Those are actually two great examples of ways in which companies that are not tiny are able to connect with their people. Mm-hmm. In ways that are not necessarily directly focused on the profit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mari, I wanted to actually go back to something you said about the very tiny businesses, the solopreneur businesses. Mm-hmm. When you talked about surrounding yourself with support, mm-hmm. I wonder if you could go a little bit deeper on that, because I think that's something that solopreneur business owners often overlook as being really important to building a thriving workplace for their business.
Well, I see it as a critical piece, and this is speaking from my own experience with this. I started this business about 13 years ago, and at various points in time, it's been just me, or it's been a whole, you know, group of people that were, you know, working on the team. So, you know, we've had, you know, different levels of growth and expertise within the organization. And one of the things that I found was, you know, it could be really, really lonely out here if you don't have business advisors, you know, friends, and not so much family, because I don't think there is objective, and even friends may not be objective, but people that you can talk to on a variety of different topics. I can remember early on in my business, it was like, okay, I'm passionate about what I'm doing, but is passion enough? Is it enough? Is it going to pay the bills and bring in the money that I need to live? And I realized that I needed to talk to other people who were doing similar work and who knew, you know, a little bit, maybe were a little further ahead on the learning curve than I was. And what I did on several occasions was I, you know, sort of facilitated and organized groups of other entrepreneurs within my industry for us to be able to compare notes and talk about, you know, how we did business development and how we did marketing and what things were working and what things weren't working and how the economy was impacting our businesses. Because, you know, part of the, you know, the time when I started this business was right around the major recession. And it was really meaningful to be able to have those relationships and at the same time be able to support and encourage those individuals in their business growth and be able to cheer them on when they had successes. So I felt like that network was a really important piece, both for my own survival in some ways, because I needed to be able to just have somebody to talk to about what works and what doesn't work.
What might be an example of something that you ended up taking away from the support that you created with other business owners?
I would say a lot of it had to do around business development and how to reach the target market that I was looking to reach. You know, who best to build relationships with that were going to, you know, really get me to that key decision maker, the economic buyer, you know, really as quickly as possible. And I think those were some of the elements that really worked. And also in terms of choice of services, you know, what was it that I was going to offer in my business? You know, were there a lot of different things in the field of, you know, workplace well-being that I could be doing, but I had to choose which ones were going to be the right ones for my business. And that even has evolved over the years. So it, you know, it's a variety of those kinds of things that can be helpful.
Tamari, now looking at larger businesses, in addition to some of the actions that you described previously about communication with your employees, are there ways that people inside companies can also gain some kind of support that helps to create a thriving workplace when the support is coming from outside the organization, similar to what you just described for solopreneur businesses?
Well, I think in larger organizations, you tend to have most of that, you're self-contained, I would say, in a lot of ways, with some of those resources. And although not entirely, you know, for example, if we think about a thriving workplace has of one in which the culture supports and encourages healthy lifestyles, where it's a, you know, a meaningful place to work with a purpose and a vision and values and a strong culture. You know, many of those elements really come from within the organization. So they, you know, the leaders, the managers, you know, the individuals that are really driving the organization need to be thinking about those and looking at those. Does that answer your question, David?
Yeah, that's good. Mari, for organizations that recognize that there's more that they can do to create a thriving workplace and they want to make some kind of change, How long does it typically take for the kinds of work that you do with clients for them to see positive results?
Well, it is certainly a process, and the work that we do around creating cultures of well-being has, you know, multiple steps in the process. When we start with an organization, we collect data. We do a both qualitative and quantitative data gathering to be able to create a snapshot of the place from which the organization is starting today. So we need to look at culture and vision and purpose and values and all of the different benefits and policies that exist in the workplace that create the employee experience. So we're really trying to create that snapshot of what that employee experience is like and what opportunities then exist. And oftentimes when an organization comes to talk with me and work with me, you know, what they're saying is, we think we can do better. You know, we aspire to do better. And in that way, we then take that all of that data from that snapshot and we co-create a strategic plan for their culture of well-being. And that includes a vision, mission statement, goals, objectives. We look at what the infrastructure is going to be needed to be able to add those elements that are going to create a culture of well-being, how they're going to communicate, and how they're going to evaluate all of that. And when they do that, so that kind of process can take us a few months, sometimes longer. But then once they start to execute on that strategic plan, so they've got an operating plan that they can use, you know, it can be 6 months, it can be a year. With one of my clients that I continue to have a relationship with on an ongoing basis, we did our assessment in the early part of 2017. And then by the middle of 2018, they had won, a little bit later in 2018, they had won a regional award for their well-being program. But they could see other results in the meantime with the way they were implementing programs, making changes in policies, and some of those different types of things.
And at what point in that process do companies like that look at some of the business outcome metrics?
Well, we try to tie the evaluation aspects. And these, again, these are long-term measures. You know, if they see things like, so we view creating a culture of well-being as a talent management strategy, for example. So if they can see things like reduced turnover or the shortening the time it takes to hire. Now, granted, there's a lot of complicated processes in all of those things. So we don't have a direct causal relationship between the well-being culture and those outcomes. But we want to look at those to see if they are seeing indeed if they're creating the kind of workplace that enhances the employee experience.
Right. So these are not quick fixes necessarily.
No, this is a long-term game. You know, it's not the kind of thing you're going to say, oh, look, in 60 days, we have X, Y, and Z have all changed. That's not the case, because this is a long-term approach to creating a culture in the workplace where people really feel cared for, where the policies and benefits and the culture and the environment in the workplace all support the individuals. Those take time to do.
Yeah, no, they certainly do take a long time.
Sure.
This is David. I'd like to take a quick break from today's episode to let you know that you too can do what you love and get paid what you're worth, consistently. We have a free resource to help you smash the plateau in 30 days. Go to our website, smashingtheplateau.com, and send me a message requesting your free tool. I'd love to help you smash the plateau.
So, Mari, I wondered actually if we could talk a little bit about how these kinds of long-term improvement processes work for you as the business owner, because one of the struggles that many small business owners face is the ability to generate consistent, stable revenue. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your revenue model and how the kind of work that you do supports particularly long-term healthy revenue.
My revenue model is based predominantly on consulting projects. So this has changed over time, whereas in the past, I had different types of services where we were, in essence, on a retainer with a client. So we would have an annual contract with a client to deliver services for their well-being program. And I had people on staff who would deliver those services. So that would have been a long-term arrangement where every year we would, you know, renegotiate the services and the contract. And over time, we've also had very large contracts with, for example, we had a contract for 2.5 years with the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. We were part of a large project team that was delivering a well-being capacity building program for Massachusetts employers. And that was a multi-year long-term contract. Today, the contracts that we are working on are shorter in duration, so there's more of them. And in some cases, we also have a retainer model where an employer will say, you know, we need you to guide us and coach us and make sure we are held accountable for accomplishing the project, you know, the operating plan that we defined. So in some cases, there's a retainer model with that. And then also have some speaking revenue. So another aspect of the work that I do is speaking and doing workshops. And that's a smaller portion of the revenue model for my practice.
But it sounds like the consulting is, particularly since it's over a fairly long period of time, there's some consistency and stability to it.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Now, looking back over the history of your business, is the development of the revenue models something that you developed by choice in order to provide consistent revenue, or were there other strategies behind it?
Yes, it was certainly by choice. And there was a lot of thinking, obviously, that went into some of this. Part of it was market demand of, you know, what are clients willing to pay for? What are their needs? How can we provide those services? And I would say that, you know, it's changed over time, partly and specifically around the choice of, at this point, we don't deliver the day in, day out services for organizations for their wellness or well-being programs. My focus is really predominantly on the strategy aspect of developing that strategic plan and operating plan. So again, that's a choice to be able to focus at a higher level, more strategic, rather than the day in and day out. Because my feeling is there's lots of people doing the day in and day out things, and I feel my expertise is better used at the strategic level.
Right. Now, it's really important to understand in what niche your greatest value can be delivered.
Exactly.
Mari, whom do you know personally who has done a really remarkable job of smashing the plateau?
I would say the person that comes to mind when you ask me that question is a friend and colleague named Steve Leshansky. Steve's area of expertise, he acts as a coach and consultant. And again, his business model, you know, has changed over time. And I've known him for a number of years now, where I've seen some of the different changes in his business from who he's focused on. And I would say that just the different ways in which he has really, you know, taken his message and adopted it to another target market was really kind of an interesting element around the value-based leadership work that he does with as a coach, a facilitator, and helping people really lead change well.
Sounds like a great example. Thanks for sharing that.
Sure.
And what's coming up for you in the near future, Mari?
Well, a lot of things, a lot of speaking coming up in the next couple of months. I'm speaking at a number of both regional and national conferences. Also, my book recently won a National Business Book Award. So I'm working on the promotion of with the organization that gives that award and getting the word out about my book.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And do you have a free gift you'd like to offer our audience?
Yes, I would love to offer a copy of my award-winning book.
Sounds great. So how would people access the gift? And if they want to go deeper with anything that you've shared today, where would they go to learn more?
Well, they can always visit our website at advwellness.com. And the person who's interested in receiving a free book can email me at mari@advwellness.com.
Sounds great. Mari, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau and share your insights. My guest has been the CEO and founder of Advancing Wellness, Mari Ryan. Thank you again, Mari, for joining us.
Thanks, David.
When you visit the Smashing the Plateau website at smashingtheplateau.com, you'll find a summary of each episode along with the links we mention on the show. Do you want to do a better job of smashing through the digital chaos and getting noticed by your ideal customers? I'd like to share this tip by Sean McKay, the CEO of SiteHub.
I can't tell you guys how many times I've asked people who their target audience is, and they respond with, "Everyone." Wrong answer, right? What you need to think about in terms of target audience isn't just who in the world will buy my product, who's going to hand me money, but also think about who's going to derive most value from your product and service, or even just look at who do you want to deal with most of the time? Like, I'm sure you have customers that, you know, really enjoy working with and other ones you don't. So try to figure out, group these people down, pair them down into some sort of segment. They don't just have to be demographics like age or gender. You know, we can also talk about psychographics, like what are these people interested in? What types of people do you think are your ideal customers? Once you have this answer, it's best to create a persona. There's tons of templates out there, and I'll link one here for you guys. But a persona is where you make a model customer, you name it, and you put information around it so that you know how to speak to this customer, you know how to pitch to this type of customer.
Thank you, Sean. You can get your free guided worksheet to help you determine your unique value from Sean at smashingtheplateau.com/sitehub. That's smashingtheplateau.com/sitehub. Remember to subscribe on whatever platform you listen on and leave a review if you can. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show. I'll see you on our next episode.